Hello and welcome to our round three 2020 edition of The People's Game. This week on the show, we've got the Unwatchables, where we're throwing it back to the competition's original expansion clash in round two, 1908, between Richmond and University. In the Rewatchables, we're looking back at round three, 2004, a classic between Essendon and the Eagles at the Telstra Dome, punctuated by a magical last quarter from James Hird. And of course, we've got Book Club this week in two parts. Part one is a reflection on the poetry of Bruce Dawe, who passed away last week. Part two is a chat about Hamish McLaughlin's interview with everyone's favourite umpire, Razor Ray Chamberlain, published in The Herald Sun. With me for all of that and more, as ever, is Gordon Hunter Meredith. Gordon, welcome.
Thanks, JB. So polished today as well. Look at you. Got some time on your hands to write out a little cheeky script. Love it.
Far, far, far too much free time to word introductions and do deep dives on the 1908 AFL season stuff that I don't normally have the time to do. So, yes, this stint in quarantine or in isolation is serving me well. So, moving on to the Unwatchables. Before Gold Coast and GWS, we had Richmond and University, the two sides chosen to boost the VFL from 8 teams to 10. They met for the first time in round two, 1908, at the East Melbourne Cricket Ground on the corner of Wellington Parade and Jollymont Parade, where Wellington Park is today. So, my opening question to you, Gordo, and you may have absolutely no idea about what happened in 1908, but what do you know about these two sides? What's your initial thoughts when I mention University and when I mention the mighty Richmond Football Club?
Well, first off, I think with University, I just know them being like historically bad, like just real bad from the get-go and always bad, and then so bad they got booted. And then also that they're currently a VAFA team and quite a successful VAFA team, but also one that kind of like still celebrates the fact that they were a top flight team, which I always find a bit awkward because it's like, yeah, you were, but you were when it wasn't really a competition and you were so bad that you got booted. So like maybe don't celebrate that, but you know, history is history. And then for Richmond, obviously, I always considered Richmond to be like one of the originals, but clearly they weren't. Like they were actually late to the scene for like the OGs. So, interestingly enough. And then I'm always a bit curious on how they actually came to be, because like there's so many suburbs around Richmond already in the competition. How did they squeeze out a little, you know, turf to get themselves a proper club and get themselves a catchment area? That's always intrigued me. Is like how they, yeah, how'd you validate getting another team in the inner north into the VFL?
I'm going to start with University. So big shout outs to Kick to Kick podcast. They do a kind of a yearly, so they do every season of the VFL and they've started at 1897 and kind of ticked along. So their 1908 episode was pretty invaluable in the research. So University was founded in 1859. I found out some really strange stuff just doing this. So they briefly merged with St Kilda in 1875. And played in, it wasn't like a VFA competition at that point, it was just like a football in Melbourne. They didn't win a game, they had six wins and three draws. This was pre us counting behinds. So that merger kind of fell through. They were briefly disbanded. So University died for 12 years from 1893 to 1905. And then they came back into the Melbourne Junior Football Association in 1906. So the MJFA was like a precursor to VAFA, which is where the Uni Blues and the Uni Blacks are today.
But only, like they only played junior football, or that was just called the Junior Football League?
I think it was just called the Junior Football League because it was like an amateur slash underling competition. So it wasn't the VFL. It was less than that. And it was only metropolitan. So it wouldn't have included a team like Geelong.
But any age could play.
Yeah. Junior was kind of like thrown around, I think, in those days as a term for like the twos. Basically.
Okay. Kind of like a law firm term then. Like I'm a junior footballer. Like I'm a first year type thing.
Yeah. Like a junior clerk or whatever. It's strange areas. Goes with the time. So University knocked on the VFL's door several times. They did. So before they went into that competition, they tried to come back as a club and then come straight back into the VFL. That was in April 1906. They were rejected. They went on to win flags in the MJFA in 06 and 07. They were eventually accepted by unanimous vote to go into the competition in 1908. Their uniform was kind of the famous black with the blue V. They had an optional black or blue cap in their uniform, so it was a choice as to whether you actually wanted to wear a cap. And the requirement for players was that they had to have finished matriculation, which was apparently code in 1908 for high school or VCE, or they had to be studying for a higher degree. So we'll probably move on a little bit to how they kind of fell off the chain. But initially, they were quite good. They did okay. And it was probably a little bit before some of the other VFL clubs had started to have the capacity to pay players. And when clubs started paying players, that's when university really got left behind.
And so you didn't have to go to the university. You just had to be relatively educated to play for university.
I think you either had to be studying for a higher degree there, or at the very least, you literally just had to have finished high school. There's no like specifications about where. So you didn't have to be a Melbourne University student. Yeah.
So it wasn't exclusively a students club.
No. And I think so it wasn't exclusively a students club. And I think if it had been, it would have been quite problematic, because I think that Melbourne Uni at that point only had, it's either 500 staff and students or 500 students. I don't know which number it actually is, but it was clearly a lot smaller than the entity that it is today, yeah, where there's just people everywhere and undergrads everywhere and
footballers everywhere. Fine.
And footballers, Darcy Moore is a common haunter of various coffee spots around the University of Melbourne. So there was one little tidbit that I found in the Australasian from Mark Well, who was the Australasian's columnist in the early days. So their first game, University, round one, 1908, they got belted by Essendon. Markwell basically summed it up as, oh, they just hadn't kind of worked out a good enough system to play in this competition. They're not sophisticated enough. And he wrote, and I directly quote, "I feel sure, however, that their superior intelligence will quickly enable them to import the requisite system. And I have great hope that before the season closes, they will have justified their promotion to league football." So he basically wrote that because they're all smart, they'll be fine. Yeah, anyway, good from Markwell. So Richmond were founded in 1885 at the Royal Hotel. Yes, it is that Royal Hotel.
Was the Royal Hotel always what it is now, though?
No, it wasn't.
So just a regular, like a regular, I was going to say well-to-do, but it probably wasn't well-to-do, but just like a regular working-class pub. No ill play to be seen behind closed doors.
I believe so, yeah.
Okay.
I believe so. Otherwise, there's no way the committee meeting would have ended and they might not have ever actually formed the Richmond Football Club. So there were a number of Richmond teams in the area preceding 1885. So there was a team that Tom Wills started, but most of them were unrelated to modern Richmond. The founding father, this is a real kick for North supporters. Richmond's founding father was James Charles, who was a former North Melbourne player.
So if James Charles had stayed at North Melbourne, the whole Tassie thing wouldn't have never happened. They would be Richmond. We would be North Melbourne.
Would they?
Sliding doors moment.
I don't know, though, because just geographically, like, North. The thing that struck me about all of this is how prevalent North Melbourne are in the early 1900s as a VFA club. And they kind of make a play to get into the VFL and whatever. We'll talk about it in a minute. But like, they're that old and that historical, but like, their supporter base is still not that big. So that was interesting. I don't know, that has to be purely geographical, because St Kilda have been around for a similarly lengthy amount of time.
But I think those small clubs had the disadvantage of where they were to begin with was actually advantageous, because if you lived in Moorabbin or Junction, even St Kilda Beach, it was kind of a bit of a schlep to get into the like MCG. And so if you were living in North Melbourne, Arden Street, you just go watch football at Arden Street. But when you had transport available and cheap and readily available to go from, you know, where you live to the MCG or other games and support better clubs. And then when the AFL finally centralised most of the games, well then, yeah, you are going to be kind of stuffed. It's like, why would I watch an average team at Arden Street when I can hop on the train for 10 minutes and then go watch two good teams at Victoria Park or MCG or whatever?
Yeah, so Richmond get founded in 1885. They become a VFA powerhouse. They finish top three from 1901 to 1907 in the VFA. They lose a really rough grand final to North in 1903. My favourite Richmond story, possibly my favourite football story ever now. Richmond win the minor premiership in the VFA in 1904, but they lose their semi-final to North Melbourne. And as the minor premier, they then have the right to challenge them again. So North Melbourne win the semi, they go on to beat Footscray. Richmond can then challenge them and play the grand final. Richmond choose to forfeit the 1904 VFA grand final. The reason was that the umpire, a kind of inconspicuous Mr. Allen, who oversaw all the VFA finals, he was appointed to the grand final. They basically hated him and thought he was incompetent. There was a huge kerfuffle in the semi-final because Richmond's captain came out after half-time and accused the North Melbourne players of wearing metal spikes. And Allen initially refused to check their boots, then took 15 minutes to actually do the check. So basically, Richmond just got really pissed off at him. They went on to lose the game. There was a whole lot of powwow. And so they obviously now, oh, we can play in the grand final. They chose not to. They literally forfeited the game because the VFA refused to change the umpire.
What an odd decision.
So North Melbourne supporters listening to this are probably going, gee, that's peak Richmond, because several people that I've already told this to have been like, gee, that's so Richmond, arrogant, so on and so forth. But yeah, just like, what?
If given the opportunity, wouldn't you just be like, let's go and beat these pricks? Like, what do you gain by not playing?
I'm struggling to, like, maybe they were just like, you know what, we know that we're a minor premier and yada, yada, yada. But, like, Richmond lost the 1903 granny to North. So this gave North back-to-back VFA flags. It was a strange... Yeah, I just don't know. I don't know what would make you... Well, they must have really not liked it. Hmm. Or the... Like, I think part of it was actually that the players were concerned for their own safety. And if I had more time, I'd... More time than I already have. It's probably worth going back. What do they all do for jobs? How are they making money? Yeah, yeah. You know,
that's probably the reason why as well, is that it's probably not, as you said last week, not as serious as what it is now, obviously. It's not their jobs. And, like, there's probably no money involved in winning it. So there's nothing to lose. So you can just kind of say, well, yeah, whilst it says that they won the grand final, we were minor premiers, so we're actually the best team anyway.
As I imagine, if any of those Richmond players were around, they would call it an asterisk flag for North Melbourne. So that just kind of bobbed up. So anyway, we get to 1907. Richmond are still pretty strong. They apply to join the VFL. Essendon and South Melbourne did not want them to enter. So Essendon suggested that the Brighton Football Club enter. And then North Melbourne merged with West Melbourne to form City Football Club. And then basically they were like, oh, we want in. You should choose us. So the North and West merger was vetoed. The merger happened, but Essendon vetoed their entry because of fears that it would impede on Essendon's recruiting area. So eventually, the teams that were already there decided on Richmond, but it wasn't unanimous. So they were kind of in after university, and they were the less preferred option.
So Collingwood or Fitzroy or Carlton, none of them went, oh, our catchment area might be, you know, impeded on with Richmond.
Apparently not. Again, I don't know how that makes sense.
It doesn't, is the answer. It doesn't
make any sense. It makes absolutely no sense. But yeah, none of those clubs kicked up a stink. I don't know what Essendon's reasons for not wanting Richmond was. Their reasons for not wanting the city merger, the City Football Club, are quite clear. But then by the same token, given the proximity of North Melbourne to Carlton, you'd kind of try and question why Carlton weren't kicking up a fuss there as well. Mm. A lot of it doesn't make a huge amount of sense. I know Rhett Bartlett has a lot of Richmond's the handwritten meeting notes from Richmond meetings, but I don't know if the same records exist for the actual VFL committee itself. Because if you could get hold of them, that would basically tell you the tale of the tape. Yeah. So Richmond jump in. At this point, there's still a tree on the wing at Punt Road, which is mentioned in several newspaper match reports. I can't get my head around that. There was a huge kerfuffle apparently when they cut it down. So Richmond come in, they're not wearing the sash. They don't wear that until 1914. So they start in yellow and black stripes and then changed for one season to a black jumper with a single horizontal yellow stripe. So the new boys meet in round two. So Richmond go into the clash after a first up win over Melbourne. University lost their opener to Essendon by 11 goals. It's a really high scoring affair. University kicked 14 goals, 10-94 to defeat Richmond 12 goals, 4-76 by 18 points. The Argus was overwhelmingly positive in its assessment of the match. So they basically said that to follow the scoring in detail would require altogether too much space. It wasn't a huge contest for the whole game. So University kicked 5-2 in the first quarter to Richmond's 2-1. And they were never really heeded. Their accuracy wavered in the second half, but it was pretty remarkable that they managed to kick 5-2 because in those days, behinds were so common and goal kicking was even worse than it was in 2016.
I'm surprised the game even survived that season then, because goal kicking is always the death of football. So
the question I had, and I haven't answered this either, but where the East Melbourne Cricket Ground is or was, it was closed down in 1921. I have a feeling that it was a bit of a postage stamp. Or there's a lot of houses where it used to be now. Because if you look at the size of the park that it was supposedly in, which is just next to that main Flinders Street to Jollymont train line in the centre of Melbourne, I just don't understand how you had a full-size footy over there. So it must be that it's become more built up than it was in those days.
Hmm. Is there also any word on why they had the East MCG and the MCG?
I think just need for grounds. And they always had, like, they played a lot of footy on the EMCG, but Melbourne were playing their home games at the G and Richmond were playing home games at Punt Road. And then there was Essendon used the EMCG for a while. Remember, this is the days when four games were played at 3 p.m. on a Saturday or five games in 1908. So there wasn't an option of having, like, bulk games at the actual MCG. Yeah. So it just became a home ground for the inner city clubs. Obviously, Essendon were using it for a period as well. And then, yeah, it was University's initial home ground, which does beg the question, what was going on with the University Oval in Parkville in those days? Because I'm assuming that was there.
It would be there, but it probably wouldn't be up to standard because it's not up to standard now. So
there were a couple of interesting things that I found. So the Richmond Guardian reported that one of the spectators called the umpire a regular Anki Putus. Do you have any idea what that means?
No, and I've tried to Google that six different ways, chunk it up, try and find origin words. I have no idea what her regular Anki Putus is.
I wondered if it was meant to be a regular octopus, but
is it potentially like misquoted Latin?
It could be. So that
it is university, so
apparently, it's a league term for one-eyed, or it's presumed. That's what the reporter presumed, but I have absolutely no idea. So if anyone has any tidbits on that, please send them in. The other interesting kind of tidbit from the actual game was that University basically didn't have any supporters. The columnist in the Argus wrote that they'll never make a great noise in the football world because they have not the barrackers. And it was, but they played really good footy. No one was there to see it, but they played really good footy, was basically the tone of his report.
I wonder why university sport never took off in Australia.
In the same way that it took off in America.
Because that was the precursor to all sport in America, was university sport. And especially their football was like, football is a university sport first.
I wonder if it's because they didn't have any other, like they couldn't play intercollegiate games. Like they couldn't play against, university didn't have like Monash to play against in 1908.
Yeah, true. Very true.
I wonder whether that's, so you couldn't even
interstate have interstate like competition is quite expensive in 1908 as opposed to anything else. So.
And then like geographically, if you had, yeah, so it's expensive and then you don't have the length of Australian history to have something like Oxford, Cambridge. And then by the time you get football up and running and it's up and running for 50 years, you're like, well, this non-university version is so much better. So clubs just become a thing. Yeah. I imagine that's probably the explanation, but I think that's probably an interesting separate deep dive. Because it doesn't even, yeah, England's a really good comparison because there's a whole load of inter-varsity rivals in England that have cropped up that simply don't exist here. Part of that is, I think, the geographical thing in terms of the UK is one of the central factors that changes it compared to Australia, and then America having, you know, a longer settled or colonial history than Australia is probably the other one. So the standout performers, Mr. Martin Ratz, who was a student from Ballarat, kicked 4 goals for University as a Nuggety Rover. Richmond had 2 recruits from Collingwood. So they had Charlie Panham, who kicked 3 goals. They also had Dick Condon, who was, you did hear that name correctly, who was their captain coach. So they clearly, when they entered the league, did a bit of poaching and got a few people to cross the tracks from Collingwood. So that started from the get-go. It wasn't just the 1980s and 70s where that kicked off. I think the most interesting figure who played in this game was a guy called Bill Lang, who was actually Bill Lanfranchi. Lanfranchi? Can you read that? What does it say?
Yeah, Bill Lanfranchi.
So he was praised at length for his performance. He was 185 centimetres and 89 kegs. He was, I'm assuming, derided at various times in VFA football for being too slow. Apparently, this is the game where he answered that criticism. The interesting thing about him has nothing to do with football. So he retired in mid-1909 to pursue his boxing career, and he was the first Australian to fight for the world heavyweight title. So he fought Canadian fighter Tommy Burns at West Melbourne Stadium on the 3rd of September 1908. So while he was still playing football, and at that point he was already Australian title holder while he was playing, and he defended the title 5 times, which earned him the world title belt. So he didn't win the fight. He knocked Burns down in the second round with a left hook, and then Burns got up before the end of the count, and then Burns KO'd him in the 6th round. So I think this was mentioned on Kick to Kick, but like, I don't think Australia's had more than a handful of fighters actually fight for the world heavyweight title ever.
Yeah, that's true. Yep. Very rare fight air there.
And so the other thing about Bill Lang, and I mentioned to you this off air, or this to you off air, is that he wrote a series of autobiographical pieces for the Adelaide Chronicle in the 1930s about his fighting career. So his fighting career is exceptionally well documented, as is his football career. Actually, it was pretty easy to find details on some of these guys, which was, as a researcher, it was interesting how different 1908 was compared to 1900 in terms of finding detail. I don't know why. It may just be that someone like Bill Lang lived longer than some of the other players that I've tried to research, which means that he was traceable right up until the 1950s rather than dropping off in the early 1900s. So, yeah. And then before he died in 1953, he went on to run the Victoria Hotel in Footscray.
There you go. Cross the bridge.
Cross the bridge to the dark side of the moon. So 1908, they had no sectional finals. So by this point, I think they ditched sectionals in 1901. So they're now using an Argus system. Neither of these teams, the new teams, made the finals. So University finished 6th, with 8 wins and 10 losses, which is still the highest finish of any expansion side in AFL history, or VFL AFL history. Richmond finished 9th, which is absolutely no surprise to anyone. They had 6 wins, 12 losses. Geelong were absolutely terrible this year. So Geelong only won 2 games, but it was pretty much a 2-horse race. Carlton and Essendon finished 1st and 2nd, and then played off. Carlton and Essendon both won their semi-finals and then played off, and then Carlton won. Carlton being the minor premier meant there was no challenge, so it was just a Carlton premiership, and they had a really dominant season. They finished 17-1, Carlton. That might make you pine for better days if you're a Carlton supporter, but that's kind of how it ended. And then University were quite good for their first 3 seasons, and then, as I mentioned a little earlier, once teams started to pay players, they struggled. They lost their last 51 games and left at the end of 1914. Their last win was in round 3, 1912. That was also against Richmond at the MCG.
It's quite interesting there, based on that letter then, that so the teams at Richmond would be poaching players off in the catchment area, which they did, would be Carlton, Collingwood, Fitzroy, and they all finished above them anyway, but Carlton and Collingwood finished in the finals. So obviously that's the reason why they didn't really care and let them into the competition. Weirdly though, Essendon finished second, as you said, so why do they care if University enters the competition? Like, they're clearly super strong. They had a super dominant year. They went, 15-5, including finals. So a bit odd that they're like, yeah, they were so anti another team coming into the competition if it meant the growth of the league. So weird areas.
Yeah, so they took exception to North and the Northwest Melbourne merger thing, as opposed to uni. But yeah, that something is strange. And I think the Collingwood players that Richmond recruited were on the way out rather than kind of being in their pomp. So they were both guys that have played nearly 10 seasons. So I think it was a case of let's get a couple of veterans in who Collingwood probably don't want that much. I'm speculating, but that seemed to be the tone of the recruitment, well, rather than them going across the tracks and poaching Collingwood's very best.
Hmm. My final question on this before we wrap up is that if you were playing at university, and you are a Melbourne University alumni, do you hold those years in esteem and you go back and you talk about it and you go, yes, like we were a VFL club, or do you just focus on your VAFA now that you're dominant and kind of put that into the dusty annals of history?
See, I've had someone that played for the VFLW team at Melbourne Uni talk about the pride of wearing a VFL jumper. And I think it's still relevant. The fact that they were the only proper amateur club to play, I think, is something that people like to kind of hark back to. The counter to that, and I'm 100% sitting on the fence here, the counter to that is that football in that era was so different to what it is today that I often think this would be, like, if the VFL hadn't been the competition that turned into the AFL, we wouldn't be sat here talking about the VFL in 1900, like, in its own right. It's only the fact that there's been a linear progression into the modern elite competition that we tend to sort of pedestal this football. Is probably,
I disagree with that a little bit, because I feel like the other state leagues can definitely pedestal their competitions, especially because their interstate competition when they had was actually fiercely fought, and there actually was a battle to see which of the premier football leagues was actually the premier football league. So I think that's probably unfair. I do agree though, like 1908 is a bit early for relevancy, like 40s, 50s, 60s, that makes sense. It's kind of like if you go over to England and people are talking about, like, in the back of the old first division days, and it's like, oh, my club, which is now in like division four, has you know, three or four division one titles, but they're all from like pre-war. And you're like, well, doesn't really count, does it? Like, if you're still lacing up your jersey as well as lacing up your shoes, your premierships probably don't count, in my opinion. But
I don't know why you're knocking lace-up jerseys. We should still have them.
For throwback round, you reckon I should bring back the lace-up jerseys?
And they have to be woolen.
Yeah.
So, like, they itch the bugger out of modern-day players. Yeah, we should do that. Now, I think the thing is, and I kind of forget, like, this is 112 years ago. So,
yeah.
Maybe we do. Maybe people do hark back to it too much, but I don't think I have any... I'd be loath to criticise a footy club for kind of celebrating their history and where they've been and where they've come from.
Yeah, 100%.
I don't think that's really ever a bad outcome for anyone.
And we still laud Babe Ruth, WG Grace, Victor Trumpa, Collegian, US football. Like, you know, it's all something.
Our producers tell me there is long enough for either side to win.
Thanks.
131 apiece. Here comes Hurd again. Can he be the hero? Or can Lloyd be the hero? He gets to the front, no mark. Eagles have numbers around the football. Jones on hands and knees. Lloyd taps it out. Judd at the bottom of the pack. It's a bounce. James Hurd got that ball out at the centre bounce. He's moving down towards this contest. If anybody's going to get it, it'll be James. McDougall heads for the boundary line. Maybe Murphy should have kicked. Bull
So the rewatchables this week. In round three, 2004, James Hird single-handedly beat the Eagles with a last term for the ages. In the week leading up to this clash, the Essendon skipper was under intense scrutiny after a verbal tirade directed at umpire Scott McLaren in the Dons' round two loss. He was fined $20,000 and forced to take part in a three-year umpire promotion program. Still have no idea what that would have involved. The Dons were under pressure on the field too. The famous cap squeeze that saw them trade a suite of premiership players at the end of the 2002 season meant they were frantically trying to halt their slide down the AFL ladder. They snuck into the finals in 2003, but lost in the second week. And heading into this clash with the Eagles, they were zip and two. The mob from the West moving in the opposite direction, thanks to a new trio of exciting midfielders. Chris Judd, Daniel Kerr, and of course, Ben Cousins. They jumped from 14th in 2001 to play finals in 2002 and 2003. With ageing stars Philip Matera and Glenn Jakovic still going around, the Eagles headed into this clash in form after a win over the Dogs and a close loss to the comp's early pace setter, Port Adelaide. So, Gordo, I'm going to throw to you straight off the bat. So I want you to give me the story of this classic in less than 1 minute.
All right. Here we go. Timer on. It's a classic contest between two supposedly bitter rivals. West Coast looked gone early as Essendon kicked the opening eight goals, and All-Australian ruckman Michael Gardiner limps off with an injured PCL, basically giving free rein in the centre to Essendon. The Eagles worked their way back into the game, however, kicked a few goals at the end of the first term to keep the game alive. And eventually becomes a to-and-fro tussle in the middle quarters with some magical play from those stars that you mentioned from West Coast, setting up one of the best final quarter performances that the AFL modern-day era has ever seen. Under siege, Bombers captain James Hird caps off one of the games of his career by kicking the winner from the boundary in the final minute. But in all honesty, this game is more about spearhead Matthew Lloyd, who was also under media scrutiny for being lost out in the field in the previous weeks. He kicks eight after escaping suspension the week before on appeal. And West Coast were well served and gave a glimpse to their star-studded but also clouded future with midfielders Daniel Kerr, Chris Judd and Ben Cousins dominating and getting the Brownlow votes, whilst James Hird was left with none. Don't piss off the umps, James Hird. That's what all that says.
So final score, Essendon 22-5. 22-5.
I do believe they went 16-2 from set shots that night as well.
Yeah, so 22-5, 137, defeated West Coast. 20-11, 131. So I'm going to get your initial observation when you watch this back. The game's still on the KO Classic archive for anyone that wants to play along at home.
Yep, under the 2000 section, as pointed out by JB in the pre-podcast meeting. My initial outtake on this game was, holy shit, Essendon irrelevant and kind of good. And it's been a long, long time since I've ever thought that. And my second outtake was immediately that I disliked every single Essendon player in this game.
Every single one?
Okay, every single is probably too hard. I really like Dean Rioli. Other than Dean Rioli, basically every other player just gives me the irrits. I did not enjoy watching this. This was, for mine, a very hateable team.
God. Okay, we'll talk about James Hird in a minute. So I had weird vibes watching this. And I reckon the reason... So I'm a 94 baby, which means that the first years of football that I think I can actually say with any confidence that I remember are 99, 2000 and 2001. All years where Essendon are very, very good. Mm-hmm. I think the first football result I remember being like, whoa, was the 99 prelim where Carlton beat Essendon. So watching this was all sorts of flashbacks to that era. We'll kind of get to some of them and the reverence or lack of for some of the Essendon players later. But the biggest outtake was really for me was actually an Eagles one. So I was too young to really remember Glenn Jakovic. So I enjoyed watching him. Philip Matera was really enjoyable to watch. Neither of those players made it to the 05-06 dual grand finals. Matera was a late withdrawal from the grand final in 05 and Jakovic retired at the end of this season, the 04 season. But then just watching like the emergence of that new brigade, so the three amigos, was pretty pretty special. Like, I think when we talk about particularly Cousins now, it's easy to forget how bloody good he was.
Mm. He was magical. He was insane, actually. And what I found, and we're probably going to segue into it, but what I found quite strange was obviously that James Head was in the paper because of the umpire bashing the week before, but like the commentary team was just going absolutely nuts on James Heard, who didn't really have that good of a game other than the final quarter, but not really giving that much kudos to Ben Cousins. Ben Cousins would do absurd things, clear the ball in miraculous ways, kick goals from long distance, do all sorts of just miracle work from the football sense, and not really get the kudos. And I was kind of just like, are you not watching the same game I'm watching Robert Walls? Like, what's going on?
Well, there is a moment where they talk, I think it's like halfway through the third quarter, and one of the commentators basically goes that, basically says that Cousins has had 100% time on ground. Like, he hasn't been to the bench.
Mm. And he's still faster than everyone, more skillful than everyone, cleaner than everyone, and he's run the whole game. It's crazy.
So particularly, I was kind of watching it going, oh my God. And then I think it was Robert Wall said that, and I was literally like, oh my God, all over again. Mm-hmm. Oh my God, times two. So we have to, I think we'll start with the end. So the final stanza is all about Heard. So he's probably not in the best 10 players on the ground in the first half. He lifts in the third quarter. Then he has 15 disposals and 6 clearances in the final quarter. There's seven touches in the first 10 minutes. Bearing in mind that the Dons had led by 42 points in the first quarter. So going into this last quarter, you're kind of like, I don't see how Essendon don't just get run over here. He kicks a goal in one of the plays of the game just after the 5-minute warning comes up. So I think you were going to talk about that later. Begins with a Dustin Fletcher rush behind. Then he starts the chain that sets up a Matthew Lloyd goal. And then the final, like, minute and a half is just, he literally does it all. So it's 131 apiece with just over a minute left. Tim Lane yells out on the commentary, there's enough time for someone to win. The Essendon ruckman, I'm not sure who it was, drops it straight behind him. So just straight behind himself into Heard's lap. Heard bursts away from the stoppage, bangs it inside 50 to Lloyd in a one-on-one. The ball goes to ground. There's a huge scrimmage. It's another ball up. You then kind of, it's beautifully captured by the cameraman. So Robert Walls basically goes, if you just look at where James Heard is now, he's just moving down towards this stoppage. Then you literally get the footage of him coming, it's running. And then they zoom back in. McDougal punches it to the boundary line. So he punches it boundary side. For some reason, I think it's, who's the Essendon player? I'm not sure. I think it might be Murphy. Picks it up, brings it back into traffic, which makes no sense. It spills out. Judd wins it. He's then tackled and slung by Hill. His handball goes to the boundary line. Marcus Bullen is the secret hero of this sequence because he picks it up and throws out a diving handball in front of Daniel Kerr, which sets up James Heard on the boundary line. It's probably like 30 metres out. Basically, it's time to gather, look at the goals and then kick, slots it. And it's unreal. And then he just runs off straight to the fence, hugs that Essendon supporter who's now had the moment of his life. And Essendon go on to win. There's 24 seconds left when they bounce the ball in the middle. And I think there's one contest that Essendon have to thwart basically to win the game.
Hmm. I have a contrarian take to this game, but Heard didn't deserve votes. And Heard's last call wasn't even that good.
Ooh.
In the sense that, yes, he was everywhere. But like when Cousins was everywhere, Cousins was hitting people laced out on the tit. And all of Heard's clearances were just like bang it forward. It was like classic a classic Dangerfield game where it gets the stoppage, yes. And then he just bangs it forward and hopes that the one-on-one goes their way. He's not hitting people out, laced out. And it's more that West Coast's continuous bad defending for the whole game lets Essendon, in particular Lloyd, have free space to take these marks. Whereas, like, I think Murphy had a better game, and Murphy's goal from the boundary in the third quarter is far better than James Heard's goal from the boundary at the end of the game. Even his goal in the last quarter is much better than James Heard at the end of the game. But Judd and Cousins are like laser beam precision, hitting targets, getting Djakovic open, even though he can't really kick straight that night. Getting McDougal open, who was an excellent forward as a youngster with his three goals. I just think if you take the narrative out of this game, like even, you know, I think Quartermain in the last sequence just says like the fairy tale is complete. Like the whole game, I was watching this replay with my housemate and she's not watching. She's just listening to the commentary. And she's just like, this sounds like a James Heard wank fest. And I was like, I have to agree with you here. Like he's, as you said, he wasn't in the best 10 players for the first three quarters, yet Robert Walls all night long has just been like, James Heard's everywhere. James Heard has a steely look in his eyes that lets you know he's come to play. And it's like, it was good. And he kicked the winning goal, but he wasn't in the best five on the ground.
So the contrarian take to contrarian take is that I reckon, but so from what I remember, this was Heard's career. Like, so he wasn't necessarily a bulk 40 possessions precision, but when the heat was really on, he would be the person that would go into the midfield for Essendon and win the contest and win the clearance. And then much the same, like there's a bit of it in this game where like it kind of goes like where James wants to go. He's like, I'm just going to go hang out at full forward because that's where I feel like I'm most valuable. So I feel like he was more, he's just a moments player, and that's why I think people recall this game in the way that they do when they talk about his career. And it's, I can't remember a night after this where he did anything similar or as pronounced, because the two teams kind of go in the opposite direction. So you mentioned Judd Kirk Cousins. This is probably the last night where he goes toe-to-toe with them and he's the player that defines the result with the final play.
Yeah.
Defines it with the final play, not the overall. Whereas I reckon in the seasons that follow this, he's probably not at a level where he can do that. So it's probably a little bit of, there's the narrative in the week before, but then looking at this nostalgically, it's probably the James Heard swan song before the actual swan song. It's like that last moment where you were like, oh yeah, James Heard really fucking good.
Yeah. It's probably his last game where he can lay claim to the fact that he is the best player in the comp, potentially.
Where he's even in that conversation.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think you probably see...
And there are those battles in between players, more so in basketball because there's less people on the court, but it happened here on this game as well, where you kind of have, it's Heard, Lloyd, maybe Murphy versus Judd, Kerr, Cousins. And that's kind of it. And they're like being like, which of the core units are better? And so it's interesting in that regard. And also interesting in a way that I actually think West Coast core had a better game, but Essendon won the game. I also just don't understand how this was ever an actual game. Like, how was this close game ever? How do you kick the first eight goals of a game and then almost lose?
We'll get to that in a minute. So I want to scale back to James. So were you a James Heard hater when he was a player?
I wasn't a hater. I just never really liked him. So growing up, my favourite players were either like Braveheart characters. So Michael Voss, loved him. Nathan Buckley, loved him. Basically, anyone that played in that dominant Brisbane Lions era, I'm a big fan of. Especially that midfield. That midfield six, probably best midfield ever, in my humble opinion. Then I also liked Larrikins, like Akermanitz. So that Brisbane team was full of it for me, even though I bagged for Richmond. But yeah, and then like for me, as you said, everything you said about Heard that defines his career, how he went where he wanted, he drifted in and out of games, he popped up when the moment wanted him. He just reminded me of like a really annoying private school footballer that kept his white shorts clean in games. Like that's the kind of guy, him and Lloyd are the epitome of footballers that I detest. Like pretty boy sooks that have a go at the umps, that stage free kicks, that's more Lloyd than Heard. And nothing's ever their fault. Like it's always someone else's problem, always someone else to blame. Was what I got from them growing up. And that's why I disliked them.
So I'll talk about Matthew Lloyd in a minute because I immensely disliked Matthew Lloyd. But I was a big, Heard was my favourite non-Richmond player.
Why? What about him?
So I read his book. He had a season diary in 2002 called Challenging Times. What a name for a footballer's autobiography.
That's my point. That's part of my point is that it's not. Yes, you had your face caved in. I understand that, but you play footy. You are the best player on a great team. Well, you've already won a Brownlow. You're getting paid a lot of money for that time of the league. Just play footy. Like, stop your whinging. it wasn't a challenging time.
Yeah. And so I kind of watched the highlight because he got his face shattered by Mark McVay's knee. Mm. And then there's a couple of things. So I found a clip of that, and it's a Dunstall clip from Fox Sports, like 2002. And he calls him Gentleman James Heard. And then I remember, like, so my grandmother used to always say that James Heard was too good to be true. Like, she said the same thing about Tiger Woods. She was just like, I don't know when we're going to find out, but we're going to find out. Like, there's something wrong with this guy. He's not squeaky clean.
Smart woman.
Didn't get it from nowhere, mate. It was a really interesting watch, because watching Heard now, I've kind of drifted from actually liking him really. But in those days, I was an avid Heard fan. Which leads me to my next question. Can you see any proposition or prospect of him regaining the reverence that football had for him pre-supplements, if we jump forward from this 2004 night, 10 years on?
I don't think so. And I think it's because we've discussed this in previous seasons, that if the footballer's issue is off-field or not performance-based, you can't have a fairy tale redemption story that happens on-field. So that was part of the problem with the commentary in this game, in my opinion, was, you know, when he kicks the winning goal, hugs the fan, it's like the Heard's fairy tale is complete. Well, it's like, no, he got in hot water for abusing umps. So until he comes down and apologises for that and says, you know, I'm sorry now, I respect umpires, like, that's no fairy tale complete. He was a good player beforehand, he's a good player now, he had a good game. Like, that doesn't solve anything. And so that's the same thing now. If he comes back into Essendon, whatever he's doing with his podcast, and coming back to, you know, make right with the Essendon fans, but it's like, until he cops it sweet and says, we stuffed up and we took advantage of these players and we took advantage of our members and we lied and we did all this, well, then he's not going to solve anything. So, no.
I put this to the sort of the enclave of football muffies that we associate with. And someone mentioned that there's a similarity with Steve Smith, but without the opportunity to actually do anything on field, which is kind of what you've alluded to. How does that kind of sit?
Well, I don't think it would matter. Like, doing it on field, like him going back to coach Essendon and win them a flag doesn't absolve him of a responsibility, because what he did was, like, beyond football. It was, you know, very close to being illegal. So it's not that his redemption can't be found on the football field. It has to be off the football field.
Yeah, so Essendon have got a new podcast called Working Through It coming out tomorrow night. So when are we recording this? Tuesday. So it's coming out Wednesday with Job Watson, James Heard, and CEO Xavier Campbell. Where members are actually going to be able to put questions to him. I think it's his first public or Essendon sanctioned appearance since. I'm almost tempted to tune in to just see how it goes. So from an Essendon perspective, there's kind of a gradual, I think, a desire to kind of reintegrate almost some time on. How that goes remains to be seen. Like, his son is obviously on their rookie list, which drew headlines a few months ago. So kind of, it's a bit of a watch this space in terms of where Heard actually goes.
And it would be disappointing if he became a lost son to that club, because he obviously had a very important player role. And an important, you know, he's a pivotal part of their history, both good and bad, on and off the field. But this podcast does reek, in my opinion, of the political sense of controlling the narrative. Like, if he's going to come back into the AFL, it may as well be on our terms, that being Essendon's terms. So we can control the questions, we can control the narrative, we can control what headlines are written about it. Yeah, we can own that space and hopefully profit from it. Like, that's the part I'm just kind of like, it's all very calculated. It's all very James Heard. It's how he was when he was a coach. It's how he handled the whole saga. It's how he was when he fled. Like, yeah.
Could be right. So we've already mentioned this question a little bit and ticked some of this off. So who was the lead performer? So the Brownlow votes were Lloyd 3, Cousins 2, Judd 1. Is that correct?
If you can get maximum votes in a losing games, I'd swap Cousins and Lloyd, because Cousins, in my opinion, was definitely the best player on that ground on that night. But Lloyd kicking 8 goals is the reason why Essendon won that game. And Lloyd kicking 8 goals is the reason why they should have won that game in the first quarter. But they didn't, because defence didn't exist in 2004, apparently.
So Lloyd kicking 8 was 8 straight from 9 kicks. I loathed him so much. He, like everything you've said, clean white shorts, just how readily he went forward to try and get a free kick for pushing the back. The fact that he continued to throw grass up under the roof at Etihad in his goal-kicking routine. It just brought like traumatic flashbacks from my childhood watching him kick bulk goals, because he used to always kick bulk goals against Richmond.
Well, so to be fair, he kicked bulk goals against everyone. He was a good footballer.
So you've alluded to this already. Essendon get 42 points up and don't shut the game down. And watching this, there's like kickouts in the last quarter where they show the behind the goals vision, and I'm like on the couch having a fit because there's just so much space. So they just let the ball get transitioned so easily. My real question is, why on earth did Sheedy not just shut this down? So Robert Walls, who you hate, makes the point in the third quarter that both sides are just leaving their forwards really deep at centre bounces. So anytime they win the ball in the centre bounce, they can break for like 25 metres and hit a lead up forward with no pressure coming off the back of the square. So I just don't understand why Sheedy didn't change initially. And then when West Coast actually got an ascendancy in this game, like, why did they just allow Essendon to keep banging it into Lloyd in a one-on-one while he was on the lead, which is probably his strongest position or strongest place to be?
I think, that was just the way that these two teams played footy. They liked high-scoring, aggressive, attacking football. They liked to entertain the fans, I think. But B, I think because before this game, there was all this talk about this West Coast midfield was going to dominate and really kind of control the middle, and they didn't in the opening quarter. So I think it looks like Essendon got sucked into thinking, well, we have the midfield measure today. So if we keep it as a spaced out game, if we win the centre bounce, we'll get the kick to the inside 50. Lloyd will take a grab and kick a goal. And that essentially is what happened the whole game. And so if it isn't broke, don't fix it. But then obviously it leaves you open on the counter. But it also just seemed like that was the general gist of football in that era, was just try and kick goals and don't worry about defence. Because even Robert Walls on the commentary, he was lambasting Fletcher for not just torping it down the middle of the ground every time. So it just seems that everything in that era was a bit basic in terms of, we'll try and win the middle stoppage, bang it forward, take a mark, kick a goal. Like, there was no zonal pressures. There was no shape around stoppage. There was no balance. There was no running off the square. It was none of that. So I just don't think they had the levers trained in them to be like, we're up by 8 goals, let's pull the handbrake.
I mean, this is before Malthouse kind of pioneers the forward press. And before the drab Sydney Eagles grand finals of 05-06 that were close but low scoring. So it's pre kind of Paul Roos becoming a little bit ultra defensive and the Eagles kind of having to correct to compete. So there's all of those permutations, but it is just weird. And I noticed that just with a lot of the footy, everyone was just like, oh, bulk uncontested marks and hitting targets. And if you could do that, just kick going.
We're watching old games since we've had the lockout. Kind of shows that coaches are also kind of happy to go with just like 50-50s from the middle. And so we see these comebacks. You had the comeback Carlton versus Essendon in 99. And then you have this comeback from 8 goals down in the first quarter. And it kind of just seems like centre clearance are going to be just a 50-50 coin toss. And everyone knows that the longer you toss the coin, the more likely you are to get to 50-50. And so that's essentially what happened in this game, is that Essendon won the first 8 coin tosses, kicked 8 goals, and then you have to keep tossing the coin for the rest of the game. And eventually it evens itself out because every centre clearance is a 50-50 contest.
But you don't have to keep tossing the coin. That's my point. There's no 6-6-6. Exactly.
But no one decided to until the very end of the quarter, like the very last quarter.
Sheedy floods in the last 10 minutes of the game. I'm like, what?
Why didn't you do that from quarter two?
Like, I felt they should have just lost for being stupid. Like, yeah, it was infuriating. Like, that was the thing. Because when he pulls the flood out, I'm like, what?
He doesn't want to do it.
The thing is, when you have a 42-point lead, you don't even have to do it when you're 42 points up. You can do it when you're like I don't know, 30, four goals up.
Yeah.
Like, your lead's been half cut, and you're like, oh, guess what? If we keep doing this, look at what's happening. So you don't even have to, like, 42 points is enough that you don't have to make the change immediately. You have time to sit on it and wait and let the plot boil.
So looking through the other games that have made it to the classics on KO and AFL.com during this breakdown period, it seems to me that the format is very similar to basketball. So I pose you this question, is that the recipe for a classic game is just free scoring for three quarters, let that 50-50 coin toss in the center even itself out, and then have a tight last quarter, very synonymous with basketball. So it comes down to the final shot and which ace player takes the clutch moment. Because that seems to be the recipe for a lot of classic games. 89 grand final, 99 prelim, this game, most other games.
It's funny because my immediate response was that that rings true for anything that happened before 2010. But then I was thinking about the 18 grand final, which is, I think, probably one of the best contemporary games. And then I was thinking about that kind of also fits the same mold, doesn't it? Like, you have a Collingwood blowout early in modern terms. The Eagles kind of take two quarters to peg it back. And then the strangest thing that happens in that game is the coin toss at the start of the last quarter gives Collingwood another two-goal buffer. Because at the start of the last quarter, you're just like, oh, just West Coast is win. And then Collingwood literally kicked two goals from centre clearances. And you're like, well, fuck. So maybe it is. I think the exception is, I think the point that there's not a lot of games that are just neck and neck from start to finish. Probably the only one I can think of that is really recent is the Bulldogs GWS prelim in 2016, where the only time
05-06 grand finals.
Were they neck and neck all day?
They were close all day, yeah. Because they were low scoring as well.
I think that the major thing is just closeness. But I think in lieu of that, people prefer the seesawing where both teams have their moment or their quarter. Yeah, they have the period. Well, that's 89. So 89 is like Hawthorn just kick bulk goals. People run into each other. They spend two quarters just playing footy. And then the coin toss hasn't evened out. And then in the last quarter, it starts evening out because a number of Hawthorn players, you know, don't have spleens or have punctured lungs. Like, there's a fair bit going on. But that game only gets really close at the end. So it does fit the basketball model. So maybe,
And basketball, I suppose, at the moment is possibly the most popular sport in the world. So maybe that is. Maybe that is the incentive of what the recipe to build a good narrative is set up with a gradual build and then have all the tension in the final period, stanza, quarter, whatever it is in whatever sport.
Yeah. I think as this year moves on, it will be interesting to see whether we end up with games that fit that billing and whether they're games that are actually more enjoyable to watch in retrospect. And that's probably, I think that's a kind of a watch this space. I don't know if there's a definitive answer just yet.
Did you enjoy all this game or just the last quarter? Rewatching it as a neutral.
I enjoyed this. I watched it once and then I watched the second half again. So I hated the first 25 minutes because I was just like, what on God's earth are West Coast doing? Why can't they defend? Matthew Lloyd is just kicking goals. What are they were in arrears in the first quarter.
Yeah.
Like, and it was just one-way traffic. And I was, so it was pretty crappy. So, yeah.
And then reflexively, the second quarter is also unwatchable because you're like, well, how is this and possibly letting this slip?
Yeah, correct. So, like, the second half is classic. I guess the question is, there's another kind of watch this space. Like, will we ever get a true four-quarter rewatchable where all four quarters you can just go again and again and again? Because last week, the Richmond-Collingwood game was certainly not that.
No, last game was a two-minute game. This is a quarter game.
Yeah.
I'd probably say the 18 grand final off the top of my head is the one you could watch from start to finish.
Yeah. I mean, There's a few others. So it's the 50th anniversary of the... I'm forward thinking a bit, but it's the 50th anniversary of 1970, which we will at some point towards the end of the year go back to. I'm going to throw it back to this game. So your favourite other moment from the match?
I feel like the unsung hero of this game is Dustin Fletcher.
Oh.
So 5:35 to go on the fourth. Djokovic has probably what looks to be about 60 metres out, and he's had a terrible kicking night, but this one is clean off the boot, is going through the goals. Dustin Fletcher has to run from about 20 metres out from the goal line and dives back Mark Bosnich style to get the tip. Instead of over the bar, he just tips it through for behind. That behind allows them to set up the James Hurd play later in the game, which wins them the game. If that goes through for a goal, Essendon don't win. And
so Fletcher, what happens on the back of that?
Does that lead to
the Murphy goal?
That leads to the Murphy goal, which I also had as one of my moments. So that's inside the 5-minute warning. Fletcher actually, they proceed to go coast to coast, sets up Murphy from actually the boundary line about 30 metres out, a much more difficult kick than what...
No, James he's like 50, he's 50 metres out.
On that one, in the 5-minute one?
Yeah. Yeah, Murphy's on the arc.
From the boundary.
He's like on apex of boundary and 50 metre arc is where he's kicking from.
Yeah. And he dobs it and gives it the best double cobra I've seen in sports history. That man is a very excited man.
The lean back as well.
Yeah. He's gone, I'm the man. Everyone who said I couldn't do it, what's this name? Well, you have to look up my number because there's no names on AFL jerseys, but it still counts. Yeah.
I love Dustin Fletcher in this. I love Dustin Fletcher in terms of Essendon players that were likable. A, because he always played goalkeeper in international rules, which no one ever wanted to do. This play is probably why. Mm-hmm. So this night, he plays on Philip Matera. He's got 28 centimetres of height. So he's 28 centimetres taller than his direct opponent. They were also born in the same year, and Matera retired 10 years earlier. And it's really just like the whole like first half. He just goes, he like stands 10 metres in front of Matera. And Matera just can't get near it. I think he kicks three straight for the night, Matera, but has bugger all opportunities. And there's another rush behind. There's two contenders for rush behind of the millennium here. Because there's another one where they're in a run one-on-one and they're wrestling. And he like sticks his foot out to meet the ball. It's like knee high and like flicks it through for a rush behind.
It's not a classic goalkeeper save.
I'm like, oh my God. There is a massive play here
for him. He should have been Socceroos' goalkeeper for quite a many years.
Manuel Neuer before Manuel Neuer was Manuel Neuer.
Yeah.
No, I absolutely loved everything about his game. And it kind of made me think about where he is in the great defender pantheon. So he won the Essendon BNF in 2000 in flag year, but he was only All-Australian twice.
Because he received the criticism that Alex Rance never did. Not to go back to last week's conversation, but he is what Alex Rance wanted to be. And because a lot of these things aren't the traditional, like, tough nut defender. Like, he's a lanky, running, rebounding, stretching, go-go gadget arms and limbs type defender. He's not a Glenn Archer.
Yeah. And he did all the kicking out for Essendon in this game. Sheedy used to use his like 70 metre torp as a set play. So he was very, very good on the rebound. So he had the same skill set as Rance, probably without having the same rig.
Yeah.
And he got his just rewards when he played in strong teams. But I think the more interesting thing about Fletcher's career, and this is partly because it went for so long, is he was just there. He was there at every juncture for Essendon. He was there when they were bad. He was there when they were good. So if you actually wanted to do a full blow-by-blow and remove the context of team performance from actually assessing his career, you could do that easier with Dustin Fletcher than with any other player in the history of the game because of how often he actually got on the park and how much Essendon fluctuated in the time. They went from flag in his first year, you know, to slight drop-off, back up, down, a little bit up, down, supplements. Yeah. I had two Daniel Kerr goals in the third quarter as my other moments. So there's one where he kicks a kind of a banana from about 40 metres out. So he kind of is in a scrimmage on the wing, doesn't get it. It ping-pongs back and forth. He runs forward of the contest, reads it, when it spills out, he gets hit up on the 50. He runs 10 metres, ignores two 1v1s because Dustin Fletcher's there, and then slots the banana from like 40 out on the boundary line, like without ever looking like he's going to miss. And then with like 10 minutes to play, there's another goal where Judd kind of gets it in traffic, does his little kind of shimmy thing, kicks it long to centre half forward. Kerr's just literally times his run so he arrives at the front of the pack at the perfect moment, beats James Hurd to the fall of the ball, and then kind of zips past him, takes a bounce, runs to 40 and just drills it. And it's like, it's just trademark roving. And like the way that Hurd is positioned, it's like if he doesn't time it properly, he definitely gets caught. But he arrives like literally as the, he could not have timed it better. So he's actually still running with a degree of speed when he picks up the ball. And then there's a turn of pace that just, he's got this kind of little gap. It's almost like a horse coming down the straight at Flemington and having to go through this minuscule gap. And he like, he just picks it, runs through. And then like, it's like, he's never missing this, is he? Like, and he just, and he drills the kick as well. Like he, it's just a, oh.
That's the thing that's so impressive about those three players, Judd, Kerr and Cousins, is that their kicking is precision in all circumstances. From a set play, on the run, in traffic, in space, at full pace, precision. So good.
So your favourite cameo performer for the night?
I think I'm going to share this one. But my favourite cameo is Dean Rioli. Not because he had a particularly good game. He had an all right game. He made a lot of errors. But I just reminded me that in 2004, chunky blokes in long sleeves could still play football at the elite level. He looks like a box with arms, but it's beautiful. He looks more like a rugby league player from the early 2000s than he does an AFL footballer.
Correct. He absolutely, it reminded me of just like the physique is like watching some of the contemporary Tiwi Bombers players. So next little category was what's aged the best.
We're going to disagree on this, aren't we?
I had the Channel 10 coverage.
Now, the Channel 10 coverage so is a 50-50
Stephen Quartermain and Tim Lane in comms.
Stephen Quartermain, get him back on TV tonight. Just commentating anything. He is the best. He is the best. Bring him back. But if you think that Robert Wall's commentary of this game aged well, you have rocks in your head, JB. You wrote this was pre-senile Robert Walls. No, this was senile Robert Walls. The things he suggested in this game prove that he could not coach. What part of Robert Walls did you enjoy from this game?
I enjoyed several of his observations. I thought he was good. I thought he did what a special comments man did. None of the commentators in this group put too much mayo on things. They put a fair bit of mayo on the James Hurd story, but not too much like BT levels.
It was pretty close. It was, as I said, like if you've just listened to this game, it sounds like James Hurd dominated, was the best player on the field by far for all four quarters that this was the James Hurd show. Didn't get a Brownlow vote. Wasn't the best 10 players in the first three quarters. Like they definitely put mayo on this sandwich of match.
So the wash from this game, by season's end, Essendon had finished eighth. They lost a semi-final. They continued to slide. So in 2005, they finished 13th. And then after missing the finals for three consecutive years in 2007, Sheedy and Hurd both retire. I remember going to that game with Mum. West Coast finished seventh in 2004 and lose an elimination final to Sydney, which is a sign of things to come. In 2005, they obviously lose the Leo Barry Grand Final to the Swans, but in 2006, they win their flag in another close game. So for them, their upward trajectory continues, and really for the Bombers, 2004 is the last year that they play finals. Maybe the last year they won a final.
When children are born in Victoria, they are wrapped in club colours, laid in beribbon cots, having already begun a lifetime's barracking. Khan, they cry. Khan. Feebly at first, while parents playfully tussle with them for possession of a rusk. Ah, he's a little tiger. And they are. Hoisted shoulder high at their first league game, they are like innocent monsters that have been years swimming towards the daylight's roaring epireum. Until, now, hearts shrapneled with rapture, they break surface and are forever lost. their minds rippling out like streamers. In the pure flood of sound, they are scarred with light. A voice like the voice of God booms from the stands. Oi, you bludger! And the covenant is sealed. Hot pies and potato crisps they will eat. They will forswear the demons, cling to the saints, and behold their team going up the ladder into heaven. And the tides of life will be the tides of the home team's fortunes. The reckless proposal after a one-point win, the wedding and the honeymoon after the grand final. They will not grow old as those from the more northern states grow old. For them it will always be three-quarter time, with the scores level and the win advantage in the final term. That passion persisting is like a race memory through the welter of seasons, enabling old-timers by boundary fences to dream of resurgent lines and centaur-like figures from the past replenished continually the present. So that mythology may be perpetually renewed, and the chicken small horn return like the maize god in a thousand shapes, the dance is changing. But the dance forever the same, the elderly still loyally crying, Khan, Khan, if feebly, until the very end, having seen in the six-foot recruit from Eaglehawk their hope of salvation.
This week's book club has two parts. We'll start with the poetry of Bruce Dawe, who died last week, aged 90. So like a lot of Australian high schoolers, I pored over his laconic poetry at school, cramming details into my head for my Year 12 exam. In the years since, as I've become a marginally bigger footy nuffy, I've discovered that he wrote two poems about the game, The High Mark, no questions or guesses what that is about, and Life Cycle, the second of which begins with three especially poignant lines. I'll read them now. When children are born in Victoria, they are wrapped in club colours, laid in beribboned cots, having already begun a lifetime's barracking. So have you read any of BD's poetry, Gordo?
I have in the week prior to this podcast in preparation, but prior to that, I had not read any Bruce Dawe, nor really knew who he was, to be totally frank with you.
So follow-up to that is, are you a poetry reader? Like, so if you pick up a paper like the Saturday paper, which has a poetry section, do you read the poetry?
Yes, and I subscribe to The New Yorker and I quite enjoy their poetry, and their poetry podcast actually is quite good because the poets read the poem live and then have an interview with the producer of that podcast about the poem and how they formed it and how they made it, what it means, et cetera, et cetera. So yeah, I don't mind poetry, but I am not so well versed in poetry to name you 20 poets of Australian history or whatever, other than Clive James. I quite like Clive James.
So what did you make of these poems?
I quite enjoyed them. And I always hate using the term like accessible when it comes to poetry, because I feel like that's almost like derogatory to a poet, because it's kind of almost too simple. Like if you kind of just get it, you're like, oh. The whole hypothesis of like poetry is like, oh, you're not meant to get it if you're like a simpleton. And perhaps I'm not a simpleton, but like, whatever. It's like, yeah, very, it wasn't like, oh, that's a bit whack and weird. It was kind of like, oh, that's just nice descriptions and poetic retellings of life, which is quite enjoyable. Yeah. It kind of reminds me a bit of Paul Kelly.
Yeah, I got similar vibes when I read these. And we've had conversations before about whether poets today in society are just our musicians and whether something like an actual written poem has value. The word accessible's really interesting because I've always kind of held to the view that any kind of literary item, people have kind of too long been obsessed with bigwigging and the idea that, oh, it's meant to be really intricate and really complex. Like sometimes simple is actually just better, because what stands out about these poems, and having read a lot of Bruce Dawe poetry more broadly, he is a piss taker and he is very laconic and he is a bit of a larrikin, and that shines through. And so the accessible thing, I don't know, this stuff's written to be read. So the broader you can make your audience by actually being open and accessible, I think has to be better for the poet.
I don't know if it's better, I think it's just different. And he's just made a decision to be quite a clear, as you said, his poetry is laconic in the sense it has a like Australianism to it. So I suppose he's made a decision that he wants to be read by anyone as opposed to read by the literary bigwigs. So, and it makes sense, you're going to write poetry about football, which he didn't actually do all that much, but if that's in your wheelhouse, going to be one of your subjects, then people who follow football will be interested in it. So it kind of has to be accessible to them.
Mm. And he kind of wrote also kind of Australiana poetry. So he wrote another one called Drifters, about a family who kind of moves between country towns. He wrote another one, which I spent a lot of time on at school, called Incident in a South Melbourne Timber Yard, Recollected in Tranquility, which in itself was a piss take, because I can't for the life of me remember who the poet was. But there was a famous British or American poet who said that poetry is like, oh, it's poetry is just your recollections in tranquility. And so he actually went and put that in the title of a poem, which is about him working in a timber yard, and there's a bandsaw that snaps and nearly chops his arm off, which would have probably bled him out and he would have died. I don't actually know whether this happened to him or whether he fictionalized it and how much of the actual events in this poem occurred. But yeah, so even that poem, like, that's a non-footy poem, but was very kind of dry, very laconic, and speaks to the average punter, which is kind of my next question for you. So, like, if you're an average Joe Bloggs footy fan and you like to listen to Robbo on 360, could you relate to these poems?
I think you could. It's just about how it gets to you.
Mm.
And so, because, like, Paul Kelly is an equivalent writing style, in my opinion, and that reached Joe Blow. And even to some extent, songs like Mark Seymour's Football Train, these are all just poems put to music, so they're more readily acceptable. So if these turned into songs about football, like, that would be, they would be, I think, yeah, widely consumed and remembered and passed on and sung and, yeah, recanted on the way to football games, especially the high mark. Like, that is,
yeah,
the high mark is a much better explanation and advertisement for marking in football than Up There, Kazali.
Hot take, probably true. So that one was republished, obviously republished several times, but it featured in the Footy Almanac and the Doggies Almanac in 16 alongside the Liam Picken Grand Final mark, which is like a very, very poetic place, or just poetic and perfect place to match the poem to a single event. I think it did stand out to me, and I remember having done a bit of time and a bit of digging in Trove, like, it wasn't uncommon for some of the papers to publish, like, footy-related poems. There's one that I found that I think it was, like, the Ballarat Star. I'll have to try and dig it up again. But, like, there was kind of an older connection between those two things. And I think the truth is that we've just drifted now into having more readily available music, and that's kind of the outlet. But that said, like, I feel like if you were... I think there should be, and I hope there are, people who are willing to kind of experiment and put this kind of stuff together just in a written form, particularly for places like the Almanac. But I do think, like, it can still be a pretty broad church in terms of who you speak to with this stuff.
True, but also I think there's a danger in becoming a bit kitsch as well. So even in the music sense, we've had music in the last 12 months, Picket Palace released the footy record, their record about footy. And whilst that works as a one-off, like, if they would become, like, only singing about football, they become more like the Coulda Beans than they do an act, like, a legitimate, in inverted commas, music band. So it's hard. I think, yeah, as Bruce Dawe has written poetry about football, he doesn't write football poetry.
No, and I think the distinction's important, because I think it's not about just be the football poet, be the poet who then uses football as something that you can write about in your everyday life in much the same way as you might write a poem about, I don't know, coffee or cider. There's a Robert Frost poem about cider, which is absolutely glorious. So, yeah, it's just one of those things that I think if you're a poet and you're listening, you can include football in your subject matter.
Just relax. Okay, it's okay.
A minute, second later, what happens?
What we have to play that loss.
They're the rules, mate. I didn't write the book. I've just read it, all right?
So, part two of our book club. We've spoken a lot in previous episodes, in previous seasons, about how umpires fit into the footy landscape. And no umpire is as well known in the modern day as Razor Ray. So in another of the Herald Sun's long Q&A sections, he chatted to Hamish McLaughlin about his umpiring career. So they've done a few of these now. They did one with Anthony McDonald, Tip and Woody. I think there's kind of clearly a reoccurring contract with Hamish. So we spoke, I can't remember when it was last year, about the kind of underrepresentation of umpires in footy media. They're never really the subject of profile. They're never really the subject of anything other than complaint and vitriol. So what power is there in an interview with Razor to change how we view the whistleblowers?
I think there's just a humanising element to it, which I think is the intention. And it's definitely Razor's intention in this is to be, at the end of the day, we're just people wearing fluoro colours, blowing the whistle, as much as footballers are just people kicking the footy. And so I think there's a little bit of a plea there to be, yeah, if you can, whilst you're cheering and barracking and hoping for the decision to go your way, remember somewhere in your, you know, dormant conscious that we're humans too.
I guess my only kind of question with this is, like, so I've read this piece, I've related to it. If Razor gives a holding the ball against Richmond with 5 minutes to go and we're like a point up and Tom Hawkins kicks a goal, is this going to stop me losing my marbles? I don't think I know the answer to that question.
But I also don't think I don't think that's his intention or the producer's intention or Hamish's intention. It's more the fact that mistakes will happen. The same thing happens if, you know, Tyrone Vickery misses a goal in 2016 to lose a game of football. Like, you're still going to get angry, you're still going to get upset, but it's more the point of, especially now that we have direct access to him via social media, if he has it, via other forms of communication, if umpires have it, that it's, the issue isn't then, because most of the time, if you're sitting in the stands or watching at home, is that the umpire will never actually hear you at the AFL level make those comments. It's more the fact if you continue to go on about it and go and hunt them down in social media or trying to hunt down their personal details and hit them up directly after the fact, that that's gone too far, which happens all too much, or that it becomes a normalized behavior and then it filters down into community levels where there's only 25 people watching an under-14s game and a dad decides to give it to the volunteer umpire because he's agreed with the decision. That's the stuff that this column tries to address and say, hey, umpires are real people too.
I think he's quite nuanced as well. So he's kind of, Razor kind of is accepting of what happens at your average game of football in terms of barracking and, oh my God, holding the ball and yada, yada, yada. He's kind of a bit matter of fact. He kind of, that's just what it is. I think the more interesting point is, I think he talks at one point about the treatment of umpires at his daughter's netball. And then he also talks about kids not wanting to get into umpiring because of fear of abuse. And I actually think that the two most poignant parts of the piece are him basically saying, this isn't about me, this is not about you yelling at me at the MCG, within reason, feel free. It's more him saying, like, you've got to not go to your kid's under-14s game and yell at the 13-year-old kid or 14 or 15-year-old kid that's umpiring for $50 a week or whatever, because then we never have umpires for AFL level and people don't find this an enjoyable or attractive pursuit. And I think that's probably the part of the piece that's quite interesting. The other thing that comes across is, like, Ray just seems kind of like an interesting guy. Like, kind of has this story of umpiring that starts with him aspiring to umpire in much the same way as a player aspires to play, and then he kind of rises through the ranks. So he's not really different in a lot of ways to Dustin Martin. You start out, you get into academies. So it's like, I think it does make people more aware of, yeah, what people actually need to create umpires and continue encouraging people to umpire, and also what that journey looks like and what that life is actually like.
And I also think that Ray's kind of the perfect ambassador for the AFL to get more umpires umpiring, because he's the contrarian character. He is a bit of an, you know, a left field unit. And that's what you need to be kind of as an umpire, because you kind of have to go, well, wild eye umpire, you know the abuse is coming. Like, you know there's not going to be a single game where you just go through scot-free. Someone's going to say something to you. So you have to find elements of enjoyment outside of that. And that takes quite a different mindset. And it's much as it is there is a team of umpires. It's still a very solo experience. So it's everything opposite to football. So you somehow still have to enjoy football, but then find enjoyment in other ways, or get that channel of enjoyment in a different way to a regular player would, or a coach, or a spectator. So I think him being a character and a personality shows that like there's room for that. So these aren't robots. These aren't complete weirdos. They're just different people that enjoy the game in a different way, and also you know, allow the facilitation of the game as well. But I think he gets so much criticism for being a personality during games and chatting to the players and that kind of stuff. But if you talk to the players, he's often their favorite umpire because he kind of gets it as well. Like, it's a show. He's up there with like the Mike Deans and the Martin Clattenbergs of EPL. Like, they're the referees that you enjoy the most throughout all televised sport are the ones that kind of understand that there is a performance to their aspect as well as the player's aspect. So.
Yeah, everyone's performing. I think this opened up in kind of viewed as kind of a part of a broader kind of appetite that I'm on at the moment, or diet that I'm on at the moment in terms of listening stuff. This was really interesting. So I have had a little bit of a Michael Lewis, the great American long form journalist kind of resurgence. So I read his book, The Fifth Risk, which is about nothing to do with football and about the Trump presidency and the American bureaucracy. From there, I listened to an episode of the long form podcast with him where he talked about his new podcast, which is called Against the Rules. And it's basically an exploration of umpires and referees in sport, but also in public life. So we're talking like high court judges, we're talking like Supreme Court judges, people that sit on arbitration panels and all sorts of other areas. So he basically looked at anywhere in the world or in life where there's an umpire and tried to kind of come up with an idea of why they were treated and viewed in the way that they are. So the tie-in between this and Razor, I guess, is a question as to whether the Australian attitude to umpires in sport is more hostile now than it's ever been.
I think so. And I think most of that is technology and broadcast driven. So every time there's a decision, and less so in AFL because it's mostly only score reviews that get hugely replayed often, but also, you know, there's contests and in the backs and all that kind of stuff as well, that it just get replayed so often that fans don't ever want to say my team lost because they're not as good as the other team. They want to have a way out. They want to have an excuse. They want to try and validate their anger with something that isn't going to be pushed onto something that they love. So they go after the umps.
Mm.
And so now that we have all this video evidence, they can pursue it. And they can say, see, clearly that wasn't pushing the back. See, clearly that was the incorrect decision. That should have been a goal instead of behind. Then it becomes a media angle as well, because I know that people will engage with it. So it self-perpetuates this motion of feedback where it's always the ref's fault. To an extent, we're now like hashtag ref's fault or ump's fault trends. And the we was robbed, you know, cries from social media happen. So it's like that stuff. We do hate umps more because it gives us an outlet for our disappointment. We could be disappointed in our favourite players, the thing that brings us love, our club, or we could be disappointed at this thing that no one really likes and it's socially acceptable to kind of put the blame on. And that's always been the case. Like, if you went to the game live, you could, you know, back in the 70s and 80s and probably even now, you can say, you know, the white maggot cost us. Now we can do that on social media. We can do that on talkback. We can do that on footy forums. We can do it on Facebook. We can do it wherever. So, we do hate umps more.
I think it's interesting because I'm two episodes into the Lewis podcast, but kind of the idea that he kind of puts forward is that the stars in the NBA, highly visible, show a lot of dissent. And so the kind of thread that starts to emerge is that dissent in everyday life is more visible, which then kind of multiplies the actual dissent. And that kind of starts to apply across a whole range of different areas. I was thinking a little bit about Lewis extending this to the Supreme Court, and we had the Pell High Court judgment today, which has not been viewed with any, and I'm not going to get into the intricacies of whether that was correct or incorrect, but I think in previous eras, I feel like there would have been a certain reverence for that institution that's now gone because there's a lot of dissent about judgments and court judgments, etc., more readily available in more forums, Twitter, news, etc., than there's probably ever been. And that also applies to sport, because we can see more dissent than we've probably ever been able to see.
Yeah. But also you lose whether or not the decision, and whether that's a court case, a policy change, or an umpiring decision in sport, whether the decision is right or wrong does not matter as much as whether or not it was popular with the masses. So to use today's Pell case, I have no doubt that the High Court was correct in their ruling. That's what the High Court does. They get decisions right by the letter of the law. And we had the same thing in sport. It's like an umpire can get a push in the back totally correct, and then there can be this outroar on Twitter saying the referees and umpires are over-officiating the game. So yes, it wasn't incorrect, but why are they interfering? Why aren't they just giving us the result that we want? And then if the reverse happens, then, why didn't they give me that free? Because this is the free that I want. It becomes more about popular opinion and popular result than it actually does become that the decision. So they are on a hiding to nothing. All regulators and rule deciders are on a hiding to nothing basically now in this social media world, where a mass populace can make the narrative and make what they want to happen through popularity rather than the actual determination of laws or rules.
I guess the other question that's kind of just popped into my head is, in a way, and certainly in a lot of spheres, scrutiny/dissent is desirable.
Yeah.
It's not necessarily a bad thing.
It's not necessarily a bad thing, but there's also no boundary to entry.
Mm.
To be an umpire, to be an AFL umpire, you need to be one of the 36 selected to go into that field and play. It's as hard, if not harder, than to become an AFL player. To be a Supreme Court judge takes, decades of practice and legal knowledge, but to be a commentator or a dissenter on social media requires a login and a password.
Mm. Mm. So the access is a hell of a lot easier than it's ever been.
Hmm.
So I'm going to scale right back and bring this to Razor to finish. So a lot of our umpires, we dissent against them, but they're nameless. So like even High Court judges, how many people today would have gone and Googled the names of the umpteen High Court judges in Australia?
Hmm.
Much the same, how many AFL umpires can you name? Most people would probably be able to name, as a guess, Eleni Gluftis and Razor.
Yeah.
So how much does Razor's being named consistently on commentary and having this kind of commentary-built persona play into the way that he's treated?
I think for the most part, it's done him well, though, because people know that he's a person... He has a personality. Whether or not the personality is manufactured or not doesn't really matter. But he's presented as being more than just a nameless umpire. So as soon as you give someone humanity, especially in a media presentation sense, as soon as you give them more than just a one-dimensional aspect to them, it becomes harder to truly despise them. So as much as he cops a lot of shtick, and of course there's people out there are going to say like he should shut up and just be an umpire, just blow the whistle, he's too involved, he's too present, it's too much about him. A lot of people also say, no, I really enjoy that he's has fun with it, and I really enjoy this profile, and I really enjoy when he does interviews, and I really enjoy that stuff, that aspect of him as well. And so long as he's still a good umpire or a decent umpire, an umpire to the standard, then I think he's doing a good job in advancing the calls. So.
It also... Everything you've kind of said there, so like the umpire, the kind of logic of governing bodies with their umpires has been for those umpires to be faceless, nameless, to make them, or to kind of almost contribute to the view that they are unbiased. Like there's always kind of been this unwritten law that the good umpire is the one that you don't notice. And I just think or wonder when you kind of look at something like Ray, how essentially whether that's passed and used by day now. For governing bodies to view their umpires in that way.
It's also interesting, though, that a lot of the time that's not the case in other sports. So in cricket, for instance, the umpire that has constant conversation with the players is much much higher value, has much higher value to the players than the silent umpire that just adjudicates by the letter of the law, because a lot of nuances in sport. And the same thing happens in rugby union, where the rules are so confusing that if the umpire is not constantly communicating, then the players really have no idea what's going on. So I actually think a sport like AFL is much similar to that, where the rules are kind of always in the grey. And so communication between the 28 umpires on the field at once and the players is essential for it to work. So they need to be present. They need to have communication skill sets. The players need to know them. In turn, the fans need to know them so that they understand what's going on more and are less likely to abuse them. So I actually think the opposite is now true. Like, it has gone past its use-by date. It's not just one umpire anymore. It is a team. They are the third team out there. So then we need to kind of have that communication going between umps, players, umps, fans, so forth and so on.
So that is an end and a wrap on the show today. Thank you ever so much for joining us as per usual. Next week, we're going to have our round 4 edition of the Rewatchables. Not going to tell you what it is, just to keep you in the dark and add a little bit of mystique. We will be back as ever. If you have feedback or suggestions for segments, feel free to get in touch with us on Twitter. You can find us at Sporting Chance Magazine on all social media platforms. See you next week.